Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back live for the date a lot of our Patreon members have been waiting for, but we'll get to that momentarily. What's up, Jeff? What's up, Dennis? How are things in Texas?
Stormy.
Dark and stormy right now.
And as it always happens, Jeff...
I'm excited about this episode.
I was going to say, as it always happens, Jeff's internet is spotless before I say what's up, everybody. And as soon as I enter the show, his internet starts breaking up. But that's why we're going to get started, because Texas has another storm rolling its way. But first and foremost, I've done it before. I took a beating. Jeff has done it before. He took a beating. And so now it's Dennis's turn to make our fans upset by not choosing their name when he chooses someone else's name. So now for the long-awaited, we're going to choose a name for the last giveaway. That's full of water. Of the Off the Line print by Valor Studio, donated to us by Henry Sledge. This has been sitting at the Sledge Estate since they were released. This is yours. This is autographed. And because the time is right and we're moving up in the world, I will include some of these stickers that were earmarked for Jeff. You're going to get some of the first What's the Scuttlebutt stickers that we're printing in-house along with this giveaway. So without any further ado... Or do, depending on where you're at. Dennis, go ahead and make someone happy and make everyone hate you.
So we're going to have Winston Churchill's going to pick for us.
See, what you're supposed to do is have like a young child do it. That way no one can blame him.
All right. Karsten.
Come again?
Karsten Krikorka.
Okay, now we do have listeners from all countries throughout the world, so congratulations, and if Dennis slaughtered that name, don't worry, I will reach out to you. So here's the thing. You guys don't have to be here, but you do have to check your email. I will not send an email to your email address. I will send you a private message in Patreon, which means you got to log into Patreon, check your inbox, and if you get the congratulations you won... All you got to do is send us your address. And we also do this to make sure that, you know, you're still actively there. I can tell by your subscription status, but we like to see engagement. So congratulations. I'm going to reach out to you. You are the big winner. And it's kind of cool. Our first stickers are going overseas as well. So congratulations. And real quick, let's just get it out of the way. Speaking of overseas, we got an awesome mail call. Jeff?
Yeah, so this one comes from Chris Wrigley. He says, many thanks. I've been listening to your pod since hearing about it on We Happy Few. I've got the last six lined up for tomorrow. Keep up the great work. Chris from Guernsey, Channel Islands. And then in parentheses, he includes the Channel Islands were invaded in 1940 by the Germans, becoming the only part of Britain to be captured. And we were liberated on May 9th. So first of all, thank you, Chris, for writing in. And secondly, hey, thanks to Matthew Leach and the guys over there at We Happy Few for giving us a little love over there as well. So yeah, really cool to have a mail call all the way over from the Channel Islands in England.
Hey, Dennis, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest tonight? We're very excited to have on. He's been hanging out in the very bottom right-hand corner of the show and hasn't said a word because he's been raring to go. So introduce our guest and let's get on going.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dan King is somebody that's been a hero of mine for a long time. I have not yet had the honor of meeting Dan in person, but we've corresponded quite a lot through the years. Some of the books that I've been working on with Mitch Weiss and others, because Dan's got a very, very unique perspective and what he brings regarding the history of World War II. And I am going to let him do that. But Dan, thank you so much for joining us. It is an honor to have you on our podcast.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I'm happy to be here, guys.
Yes, sir. So, Dan, like, tell us about your unique perspective and how that was fostered. How was that? How did that ignite in you?
Well, you know, I've written a few books about Japanese veterans that I interviewed in Japan in their own language, and no one's done that yet that I know of. And what I've tried to do is take their stories, their experiences, like growing up, education, training, combat, and then their post-war experiences, and put that into English and give it context to make it easier to understand, because there's a lot of Japanese expressions and phrases that the average American doesn't know, right? And I've been studying Japanese for over 40 years and I'm still learning stuff.
Well, that was going to be my first question, was let's back up a little bit. How did you
Yeah,
get into
exactly.
the passion of learning the Japanese language? Was that through school? Was it through work? Passion? How did that come about?
You know, when I was 16, my dad came home from work. He worked at a bank and he said, "Hey, you know, son, the bank is sending five students overseas for the summer, you know, children of the employees." And he says, "Why don't you fill out this form, you know, and see if you get selected? You probably won't be, but fill it out. It'll be a good experience to do like a five paragraph theme. And, you know, where would you want to go overseas if you got to go? But you won't get selected." So, okay. So I filled it all out. And about 2 months later, we got this thing in the mail. And it was like, "You've been selected for this Youth for Understanding Overseas Exchange Program for the summer." And they said, in the form, it said, "Where would you like to go?" And I talked to my parents, and they're like, "Well, you should go somewhere interesting and different and unique and weird. Like, don't go to England. They look like us. They talk like us. Our ancestors came from there. Don't go to Germany. Go somewhere really different and unique." And on the list, there was Japan. So I thought, well, that's pretty unique. It's kind of a weird country. I just finished watching the original Shogun series at the time. And I thought, well, that was pretty cool. Check that out. So I put first through five choices, I put Japan, 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 Japan. And when my mom saw that, she goes, "You idiot, they're going to kick you out of the program now. Why'd you do that?" I said, "Well, if I can't go to Japan, why go? I mean, that's where I want to go." So I went to Japan. I spent the summer there with a Japanese family. Didn't know any Japanese and picked up some, right? Got enamored with like the culture, the customs, the food. A lot of cute girls there too, I must say. And I thought, you know, I want to come back and live in this country. It's very interesting. And I came back 2 years later teaching English as a volunteer at a church. And I met my first Japanese veteran. His name was Yoshida. He was a cavalryman in China. He had a photo album with all kinds of great pictures of Japanese soldiers like brushing manes and cleaning the horses, you know, hooves and arranging tack and everything. And at the time, I remember thinking, wait a minute, where's all the babies being stabbed? Where's all the children getting their heads cut off? Wait a minute. Where this is a pictures, these are pictures of the guys smoking cigarettes, hugging each other, laughing, riding horses, feeding horses. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to me. And I was honestly confused. So I went, okay, what I've been led to believe is true about the Japanese, the soldiers, and what I experienced with Mr. Yoshida, his English was zero, my Japanese was almost zero. He attended the church that I was volunteering at. And so I said, well, I got to learn more. And to learn more, I had to learn the Japanese language. So when I went back home, I got my degree in Japanese from Cal State LA. And my professor was a kamikaze pilot.
Oh, wow.
He was 16 years old, volunteered for the kamikaze program out of Koroma City, which is now Toyota, which is where I went and worked and lived for 10 years. So weird things kind of come in circles like that.
Wow.
What
But I
year
was
was
stuck.
this roughly? Just because I'm trying
It was
to think.
1981 is when I
1981,
went to
so
Japan. Yeah, I was 16.
37 short years after the war.
It was, yeah, there was veterans everywhere.
Well, the
And you
reason I
know,
bring this up is you said you went over there and you're expecting to see what you saw representation of all the things you mentioned. And I was thinking, well, is this 50 years later? Does that generation pass? No, 30 some years later, those people are still around. So it wasn't a cultural shift. It was, oh, yeah, we had propaganda here too.
you know, my general manager at Toyota, where I worked, he was a survivor of the A-bomb, and he was 5 years old when the A-bomb was dropped at Hiroshima, and he lost his dad and his brother. And I didn't know that until I'd worked for them for 5 years. And one night I was at his house and we're having a little dinner party, and he got really drunk and he starts talking about the bomb going off and what it looked like and what it sounded like, and my mind was blown. And I thought,
Wow.
this guy has been the nicest boss to me. He's always protecting me from my assistant manager, who was really not a friendly guy. He always stood up for me. He always kind of protect me, made sure I got good training classes. He was like an ally. And here he had lost his half of his family during the A-bombs, but he'd never talked about it. And it was so interesting. The Japanese tend to keep their personal stuff hidden away. they don't bring it out in the open.
Well, that kind of answers a question that I had popping up, is which was going to be, did you experience maybe resentment, if you will, from not everybody, but from a few Japanese veterans? Because, for example, I know growing up in Kentucky, back when Karate Kid was huge, my grandfather fought in World War II. I went to the Richwood Flea Market. I bought me a bandana, had Japanese writing on it because Karate Kid was cool. My grandmother's like, hey, you don't have no idea what that says. She still had a little bit of, you know, PTSD from living through the war. So I was kind of curious, did you kind of get any little hostility from maybe some of the older Japanese veterans towards you simply for being an American?
The only time I got any kind of hostility was I went to the Yasukuni Shrine in 1990, I think. And it was August. It was the end of the war. And there were two large veteran groups assembled. And there was one all dressed in Navy uniforms, mostly, you know, reproductions, but some originals. And there's a group of Army guys dressed in all original stuff. So I went up to the Navy guys and I was like, you know, hey, my name's Dan. What are you guys doing? What's your deal? Well, you guys are in the Navy, and just kind of, you know, talking to them. Yeah, they were very open, very friendly, chatty. And I took pictures with them. Then I went to the Army group and they all turned their backs on me. And I was like, they accidentally turned their backs on me. So I walked around to the front and I said, hello, excuse me. And they turned their backs on me again.
Wow.
So one of the Japanese Navy guys came running over. He grabbed me by the shoulder. He goes, come on, come back and hang out with us. They're jerks. Don't worry about them. They're Army guys. And that was the first time I'd experienced the mindset of the Japanese Navy versus the Japanese Army.
Oh, wow.
The Japanese Navy, you know, they had to study English. And a lot of them had been to America before the war, because they had these annual cruises for the midshipmen. They'll take them to Europe or Africa or Egypt or South America. And they have traveled the world. They've seen foreign countries. And these guys are pretty, you know, pretty globalized, so to speak. They were more open to foreign people. But the Army guys, from the people I met, were generally not receptive to talking to non-Japanese people and had a little more resentment. And the more, you know, as years went by, I realized that more and more of the Navy guys I met lived on ships or lived in airfields. And so they had, you know, clean beds, you know, clean sheets. They had pretty good food. They never actually saw the enemy. They never actually saw the American troops. So maybe the Army guys, they was a more of a nitty gritty, dirty kind of.
Wow. So yeah.
Something to do with it.
We've talked about this on the past on the show, and I think you're the perfect person to maybe shine a light on this, explain this to us more in depth because of your knowledge on this, the topic at hand. But Jeff and I, on past episodes, we talked about, especially when it came to like Guadalcanal and Peleliu and Tarawa, how it seemed like the Japanese Army and the Japanese Navy almost tried to operate independently from each other, and one was doing something and building stuff the other one didn't know about, and all of a sudden now they're being tasked with protecting this. What was the root cause of the disconnect between those two militaries? I can't imagine if we saw that on our side, where the Marine Corps is doing whatever and the Army has no idea and the Navy's doing this and the Air Corps has no idea. What was the root cause of them not really at first operating as a group or working in conjunction with one another?
You know, I think it goes back hundreds of years to the beginnings of the samurai period, when the two different factions were always warring against each other, and it developed where the Army and Navy developed separately. And it seemed like everything they did was different, like their canteens were different. Come on. Japanese Army canteens and Navy canteens are different. And it's just such a waste. Right? Everything they did was different. So the thing that I thought was really interesting about interviewing the veterans is that I could ask them like questions about what did you think about America before the war? And almost all the Navy guys said they couldn't believe the war started. They thought it was stupid because many had been to the US and they had some kind of connection, you know, to England and the US. A lot of their officers had been overseas. Well, the Army guys, they were very strictly, very old school samurai mindset. Is everything Western is bad. So they were harder to interview than the Navy guys.
Mm.
But I've been lucky enough to interview 105 Japanese combat veterans. And I've started putting their stories, as they tell them to me, in book form. I remember, if I may, there was one. This is one book, The Last Zero Fighter. And there was a naval pilot named Mr. Kaname Harada. And he flew in the Pearl Harbor attack as combat air patrol. And he was in the battle for Wake Island, the air battle. And he flew in. Sorry, this is JoJo. Hi, everybody.
Hi, kitty
Hi.
cat.
Put her down. She's going to get in the way. So, Mr. Harada, where was I going? She does that. She likes to get in the way. Just, but I was talking to him, and I said, Mr. Harada, I'm going to tell your story as you tell it to me. So, anything good and bad, it's going in the book. So, if there's anything you don't want to tell me or you want me to know, put it in. And he's okay. So, I went to his home, and we were there for several hours. And then he says something about, oh, yeah, Nanking, blah, blah, blah. And I go, wait, Nanking? You were at Nanking? He said, oh, yeah, I saw it. I saw it. I was there. Yeah, I was on the ground. He said, yeah, we bombed it from the air. We dropped bombs on the walls so the troops could get over it inside of the city. And after the battle, we landed at the airfield after the army captured it. And we took a truck into the city and we wanted to see our bombs, were they short, were they long, did they hit well? Just to become a better pilot, we went in to see where the bombs had struck. And he goes, and then I saw something really horrible. The army guys were cutting people's heads off and stabbing them and slaughtering people, innocent people. And he t tells me the story, and I hit the I paused the re I had a recording device, and I said, Harada-san, this is going to go in the book if you tell me this. He goes, people need to know. He said, Dan,
Wow.
I saw it, I heard it, I smelled it. It happened. There are a lot of Japanese who say it didn't happen. It's like in Japan, the apologists are saying, oh, Nanking didn't happen. It was an exaggeration. But he said, I was there. And so to me, that
Wow.
was really valuable because he was there. And when he was telling me the story, he was staring off into the distance and he was just like remembering it, talking about it.
My goodness.
I think it's also
And
important to share that so that the reader and people know that just because these atrocities were going on at the hands of some Japanese soldiers and some participants, that not all the Japanese soldiers agreed with what was going on and not all of them participated
he
in
was
it.
very upset. He was very upset. He and the other naval pilots were standing there on the river. My wife and I went there to see it firsthand because she's from Taiwan, so she speaks Chinese. So I wanted to go to Nanking. We spent 3 days there, looking all everything, all the places that I'd read about, the river, the walls, the gates, everything. I wanted to see it firsthand, and that was something that I've always wanted to do was. You read the history, right? And then you meet the veterans, American or Japanese, you meet them, you hear their stories. And I used to be a collector, so I would collect the items that they used, uniforms, rifles, swords, canteens, things like that. So when they tell their stories, you can go, oh yeah, I know that. Your canteen holds about a quart. And they're like, oh yeah, okay. And then the wall comes down. Or when a Japanese naval pilot says, well, I flew the Zero. That's an airplane. I'm like, yeah, I know. It's whatever, AMC, but and they go, oh, you know the Zero? Yeah. And then another wall drops. And I found that the more I knew about their uniforms, equipment, and weapons, that the walls dropped and they would be more open to share and talk with me because they didn't have to explain everything, right?
Wow, that's amazing.
And so that was important to read the history, interview the veterans, learn about their weapons, and shoot their weapons, of course, right? Texas, God bless Texas.
Yeah.
And then you talk to them, and then also visit the spots that they talk about. Like, I've been to Guadalcanal, I've been to Saipan, Midway, Wake Island, Iwo Jima. So when the veterans talk to me, they'll say, I flew over Guadalcanal. I go, yeah, I was there for a week. They go, oh, you've been there? Oh, you know how hot it is, how muggy it is. And then, boom, boom, another wall comes down. And I think it's really important as a historian, as a history buff, to learn as much as we can up front before you actually talk to a veteran. So that they're not like wasting their time explaining, what something like, an M1 Garand is. Because I have one. I've shot it. I know what it's like. So that was
That's
kind of like
such
a
valuable
school for
information.
Malays, you know.
Dan, did you go into the caves at Saipan? Did you get
Oh
and visit all
yeah.
those?
I was there last March for a week. I'm working on a new book about the Japanese tanks on Saipan and Guam as a quick story. If I may, like a 2 minute story.
As much as you want, absolutely.
Okay. So this is a Type 97 Japanese tank, right? Okay. So for the movie Wind Talkers, some loved it, some didn't. I was a technical advisor, the Japanese advisor. So all the Japanese stuff, uniforms, equipment, the letters you see, photographs, all that was me. I was in charge of the script. I didn't do the, I was in charge of production. I was involved in California and Hawaii. And I remember I was at the warehouse and they had made these three Japanese tanks. And I went in to go check on them because I'd given them like the images, the things to paint on the tank, right? And the camouflage colors from Tamiya. I gave them Tamiya samples to use. And there was a big Japanese flag on the side of the turret. And I go, what's this? This is not what it's supposed to look like. This is not what I gave you. And this gentleman said, well, we're really busy and I couldn't find the file. So this is good enough. It's just Japanese tanks. No one's going to know. And I said, someone's going to know. Someone in Japan is going to see this movie. And if we put the correct markings on, somebody will see that and say, wow, look at that. You got to go see this movie. It's great. And this word of mouth will spread and it'll give a credibility to the film. And director John Woo said, you have to make it accurate. He was very, very strict about that. So he's like, ah. I said, I'm going to have to go talk to John Woo about this. He's like, ah. So they had to hire a painter in Hawaii to repaint the tank and put the correct hiragana markings on it for the 5th Company, 9th Tank Regiment, which is in Saipan. So fast forward a year later, the Japanese survivor named Shiro Shimoda is in Osaka watching a film with a tank buff, a young guy, and they're watching this movie called Wind Talkers, and a tank goes by the screen. And Mr. Shimoda lights up and he goes, that's my tank. It's his tank regiment. And
Oh,
he blows up. So the young man Kitagawa-san finds me through the internet and he says, Mr. Shimoda wants to thank you for accurately portraying his tank regiment on the movie. If you're ever in Japan, he wants to take you to dinner. So I'm like, plane ticket. So I went to Japan, I met him. He's thanking me. He gave me a signed sake cup that he got from the emperor. It's in a wooden box and another box wrapped up with a silk tie and everything. He wrote my name and the date on it inside. And I'm like, you got to tell me your story. So he told his whole story. And I went to his house again 3 years after that. I interviewed him again. And I thought, I'm gonna make a book. So from that little bit of being kind of like a nitpicky about the tank inscription
wow.
to connecting to meeting the veteran, and there was only five guys who survived from the 9th Tank Regiment and none from the 3rd Company. And the 3rd Company, zero guys. He was the only guy. And he hid out in the jungle for 2 years after eating snails and hiding from the Marines. And it's all going to be in the book. It's crazy stuff. I look back and I remember thinking to myself, somebody's going to know. And somebody did know. And if I just went, okay, put a Japanese flag on the side, yeah, who cares, whatever, then he never would have been excited. I never would have got the invite. I never would have met him. And this upcoming book
Wow.
would come together.
I wish more historical advisors would stick to their guns like you did, because that would save a lot of us a lot of pain.
It is tough because there's a lot of outside forces. Now there's money, there's budget, there's artistic stuff. I'm sure anyone who gets to work on a film does their absolute best, but it's not always. They'll say it's not a documentary. Like, yeah, I know it's not, but come on now,
Yeah, but we also don't want MASH that took place in the 50s, but everybody had their 1970s haircuts.
I know, I know. Yeah, my dad was a POW in North Korea, right? And he was watching MASH one day, and I walked in. I'm like, oh, this must be really authentic. He's like, gonna. But so, okay, so back though, this is Mr. Harada's story in The Last Zero Fighter, right? You got Pearl Harbor, Midway, Guadalcanal, Coral Sea, all kinds of unpublished photos directly
Man.
from veterans' photo albums, information that's never been published, a lot of it not even published in Japan either. Because the Japanese veterans were kind of like our Vietnam veterans. After the war, Vietnam veterans, they came home, they weren't appreciated, they weren't respected. Some of them were called bad things. And so they kind of clammed up for a long time. And the Japanese veterans, when they came home after the war, some places like from the Philippines, from Manchuria, they come home and they see Japan's been destroyed, right? And they're told, you did this to us. You military guys ruined our country. It's your fault. You lost the war. You guys would have fought harder, blah, blah, blah. And so these veterans start, they hid all their clothes. They didn't talk about their experiences. And a lot of the vets I interviewed, their wives and kids didn't even know anything. They just didn't know. They just didn't talk about it.
How was the
So,
war itself handled pop culturally wise? Obviously, here in America, we look at World War II as a certain way. We have a name for it. Over there, because they, quote unquote, lost, how is the whole topic handled over there when it's brought up?
Clint Eastwood, he got a medal for his second film, the
Mm.
second Jima film.
Letters from Iwo
And I wrote that
Jima.
too, by the way.
Beautiful.
So that I got to meet him. He was a great guy, name dropping, great guy, very respectful, very wonderful person. So up until that Letters from Iwo Jima came out, a lot of the Japanese were quiet because the Koreans and the Chinese and the Filipinos are always saying, we need some money for reparations. Give us some money because you bombed our country 70, 80 years ago. So the Japanese naturally just keep it quiet. It's just they don't want to talk about it because whenever they do, it starts coming up. So the Letters from Iwo Jima comes out and the Japanese are amazed at how the Japanese are portrayed. They're portrayed as honest soldiers who are doing their best in a terrible situation, which is what I think most people were at the time. So the emperor bestowed upon Clint Eastwood the Rising Sun Third Class Medal that he was awarded at the embassy in LA. And they only give out a few each year to non-Japanese. And he got his for the artistic work. He's a hero in Japan. And so then the Japanese started putting pressure on the government saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of dead people in Iwo Jima that are still in the caves. Why aren't you bringing them back? And so the population put all this pressure on the Japanese government. So they started digging up the tunnels and caves and bringing back hundreds and hundreds of bodies, doing DNA tests because the Americans do DNA tests and they're trying to repatriate these bones to their families. So Clint Eastwood did an amazing, amazing thing. Outside of just a really great movie, is that he helped the Japanese push towards bringing their servicemen home from Iwo Jima and, of course, other places, Saipan and Guam and other places as well. It just kind of filtered out.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
And then, so
My
this.
grandfather, Clifford Lemke, he was at Iwo Jima on a gunboat. He was providing cover fire for the frogmen, the UDTs, on the recon mission on D minus two. And he survived that, and all lost a bunch of his shipmates were killed on this mission. And Dan, of going through his stuff after he committed suicide, we were going through his stuff. He had three things from his war years. One was his discharge paper. Second was a newspaper clipping from All Hands magazine, and it was the write-up for his group that got the President's Unit Citation for their part at Iwo Jima. And the third, which just floored me, was an article of the Japanese gentleman, the soldier in the Philippines who had surrendered after all those years. And the picture on the article was of him in Tokyo coming off the plane in a wheelchair and his hands buried, his head buried in his hands, weeping because he thought he had failed, but he was received as a hero. And it just gives me goosebumps still to think that that meant something to my grandfather who had actually fought them,
Wow,
you know.
wow, wow, wow.
Yeah, it was really something. And this fellow well, I guess you can't tell me, because you don't want to ruin the book for the Saipan book, but he survived 2 years, so it must have been a very similar story.
Well, this guy did too, Mr. Aki Kusa. He hid out on Iwo Jima after the war. Yeah, hey, there you go. It's Aki Kusa. I met him. I was going through cancer treatment. I had stage four lymphoma in 2005, and I was given 6 weeks to live. The doctor said, I'm sending you home. No need to treat you. I got hospice lined up. Your insurance is going to cover it. It's been nice meeting you. I'm really sorry this happened, but best of luck. And I was like, whoa, hold on a second. Hold your jets. What's going on here? I said, if there's treatment, you're a doctor. You have to treat me. You took an oath, right? And the doctor's like, okay, you're gonna hate me.
Wow.
I'm gonna put you through a lot of really negative experiences, and you're just gonna die anyways. And I said, I'm not ready. So I was in the hospital, and a friend of mine in Japan sent me the book that Akikusa-san wrote about his experiences in Iwo Jima. It was called I Was 17 Years Old on Iwo Jima. And I read that. I went, this guy went through hell. And he's still so positive about his life. And he had a good life afterwards. And I was like, okay, I wrote a letter to the publisher, and he wrote back to me. And I was in the hospital for like 3 weeks at a time, then out in chemo in the back end. It was about a year and a half. So I got a letter from Akikusa-san. He said, do your best, King-san. You can do it. Fight the cancer and be strong. And if you're gonna make it, and when you make it, come to Japan, visit me. I want to take you out to dinner, and I want to talk about Iwo Jima. So I was in my hospital room, and it's 2007, and I'm getting a stem cell transplant. And one of my friends, John Edwards, Vietnam vet, great guy, he comes in, he goes, Dan, you got to get off your ass because we're going to Iwo Jima next March, 2008. And I'm like, no, I can't afford it. It's too expensive. I'm white. I'm like ET on the floor, all pale and crispy. And he goes, you got to get your ass out of this bed because me and Doug, another friend of ours, me and Doug both chipped in. We paid for your trip with the military historical tours.
Non-refundable, so you
You're
got to
not just
go.
saying, you're not just saying that to make me feel better. He goes, no, I'm a Marine, right? He goes, I'm not going to lie to you. I said, okay. So I told the doctor, I go, I have to get a passport renewed because I'm going to Iwo Jima next March. As the same doctor goes, you're not going overseas. You're not going on. No, you still might not make it. I said, I'm going to Iwo Jima. I got my passport. And sure enough, Doug and John, they ponied up and they got me to Iwo Jima in 2008.
Wow.
I remembered it all started with this book and this letter from Mr. Akikusa. So I wrote him a letter, sent him pictures of me on Iwo. I went to visit him. We talked. He wound up coming to Iwo with us in 2015, and he got to meet Woody Williams, the Medal of Honor recipient.
Whoa.
And they were shaking hands, and they were talking, and I was translating for it. And I'm like pinching myself because I'm translating for these two people who are both, in their own rights, amazing, amazing people.
Yes.
And there are a couple of American Marines who fought against him on Iwo, Gene Bell. He was the last Iwo Jima survivor from Wyoming, passed away recently. Gene walks up and he shakes Mr. Akikusa's hand. He goes, I'm so glad you survived. And they treat each other like they're brothers somehow, like they both survived their tornado, right? There's no like resentment. It's just, wow, we both survived that tornado. Wow, you made it. I made it. And there was that kind of friendship. And I
Wow.
saw that over and over and over with American vets that went to Iwo Jima. I've been 16 times
Wow.
with American vets
Goodness
on Iwo Jima.
gracious.
I'm so lucky. And as soon as I could translate, MHT started taking me along as, a helper translator. I couldn't afford to go that many times. No way. And I got to introduce Marines to children of Japanese survivors, and they would always shake hands and talk, and no animosity, no anger, no resentment. There's only love and friendship and forgiveness. And so I've seen it. People who were there don't hold animosity, anger, and hatred toward their former enemy. They don't. And
Wow. You know,
it's
previous.
just.
Dan, did you get a chance to meet Kobayashi's family at all?
I did. I did. I met Kobayashi's son, and I met his grandson many times, Mr. Shindo. He's the Japanese government. But I met his son Taro too. I was on that first trip. I met his son Taro. He was praying at his father's, the command post cave. It was an amazing experience to shake his hand and talk to him.
Wow.
That was the nexus for this book, the Iwo Jima book. And the back of the book has a story. There's a poem. You see that poem?
Yes, sir.
That's a kamikaze pilot's poem that he wrote in his photo album. He was killed on February 21st during a kamikaze mission against Iwo Jima. His sister let me photograph this and use it. And she gave me his scarf and postcard and the medal his family got after he killed himself. And I met her on Iwo Jima. We became friends. And the book is just full of all kinds of stories like that, the firsthand accounts, photographs, information. I've learned so much.
I was saying, Dan, you must just pinch yourself, just the
I do.
opportunities.
I do. It's like I just happen to be this dumb luck guy walking to Japan and they get to meet. And when I interview a veteran and they'll say, You should talk to Mr. So-and-so. I think you find his stories interesting. Let me call him for you. And they'll write a letter, make a phone call. And say, okay, you could go visit him next Saturday. Here's his address. And it's through that introductions, right? The introductions. Because if I showed up, this is my challenge, right? So I'm hearing a story, and like a Japanese person is telling me, a veteran's telling me a story, and it's hard to listen to. It's hard to accept. I'm an American, right? And they're telling me something that hurts me to hear. And I realize if I come across as like, oh, they're gonna climb up. They're not gonna tell me the story. So I have to like kind of be stoic and listen. And if I listen respectfully, then they'll start to tell me more, right?
Yeah.
And I so that was a challenge for me, was to hear stories I didn't want to hear. There's a lot of atrocity stories that'll come out in a later book. Stuff that happened in China and the Philippines. My ex-wife's uncle committed a lot of atrocities when he was in China. Really wonderful, sweet man, but people do things when they're 20, 21, 22 in a foreign country, in a group of people during a war. So, but he told me some things that'll be in a later book.
Dan, can you walk us through how that you are approaching the house of a Japanese veteran? How does that is there etiquette involved in how you enter the home and how you is there introductions? Like how does that look like when you're walking up to a house for the first time for this gentleman you just told us about? What does that look like?
Well, sometimes the interviews would happen like in a coffee shop or a restaurant, a public place where they feel more comfortable, and they'll bring like a backpack full of photos and things to show me. Other times they'll want to do it in their home. Like Mr. Yoshino, he was flying over Pearl Harbor in a Kate torpedo bomber. He was the number two man, the commander of the plane. He wanted me to come to his home. And it was a 100-year-old home that his grandfather built. And he was born in the room we were doing the interview in. He's like, I was born over there in the corner. And my dad died over in the next room. And my grandpa, he died over there. And I just stunned. And he's telling me the story. I felt history washing over me. And he's just talking about Pearl Harbor, flying over it. And one thing he said, he goes, when we got back, we weren't celebrating because we'd lost five ships from my squadron. Those 15 buddies were gone. And we were very sad aboard the Kaga, the carrier Kaga. He said it was a very sad moment for us. He said, but what really made him angry was after the war when he found out that it was a surprise attack. Mr. Yoshino thought that the Americans had been given the declaration of war before the planes had left the ships. So they expected to get wiped out over Pearl Harbor. They're fully expecting maybe only a few planes might make it back. And they're like, they all made it back. And they're like, well, why don't, except for the five planes on the Kaga, but majority of the planes made it back on both waves. And he didn't know until after the war that it was a sneak attack, and the whole world saw them as sneaky and rats. And it made him so angry. He said, the airmen, we were very honorable men. We enlisted before the war to serve our country. We loved flying. We loved each other. We trained really hard for our missions. We were dedicated, and the whole world just saw us as rats. And it's because the bureaucrats and the government and the politicians, they stabbed us in the back by trying to cut that window really tight before the declaration was issued. And he didn't forgive them. Like, he was angry at his own government for doing that.
Wow.
I found that really surprising.
My goodness.
His story's in that first book. His story's in this book, Mr. Yoshino.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's better.
He dropped he attacked the Oklahoma.
Oh, wow.
And then
Dan,
we
were you involved in any of the flags that get returned
Oh
from
my gosh. Oh,
souvenirs?
I've returned I've from pith helmets, flags, diaries, soldiers' notebooks, letters. I've returned letters from Iwo Jima too. And it's weird. This stuff just comes to me somehow. I don't go looking for it. It just somehow floats into my world. And people say, I want to return this. And somehow, I don't know how to explain it. It's like
What is
getting.
that? Yeah, can you tell us about maybe one of your favorite scenes where you were returning a flag or two families, and they probably never thought they would ever see those items again. And
They're
they
always
probably
blown.
knew a bunch of the people that had signed it.
They, yeah, true. They're always blown away when something comes back home after all these years. And they'll look at it and hold it in their hands and they'll say, "This looks brand new. This looks like it was just picked up yesterday." And they're amazed that the American veterans would take this off the battlefield and keep it so reverently in their lockers and keep them wrapped up and secure and safe in such good condition. That's the first reaction. They always say, "Wow, the veteran must have taken really good care of this. I appreciate the
Wow.
American family for taking such good care of this." And I remind them that, you know, American veterans took a lot of souvenirs in the war. And you know what? If they didn't, they would all be dirt right now. All those flags, letters, uniforms, they would all just been buried, rusted, rotted away. You'd have nothing. But now, because some American GI took a postcard off your dead grandfather or your dead uncle, as sad as that is, now you have that postcard. And they're always very grateful and appreciative for having that, because they can see the handwriting. You know, they can touch it. They can see it. There are too many stories of people that are just amazed when something comes back home. I would say one of my favorites was I got to meet Medal of Honor winner Ken Walsh as a Black Sheep Corsair pilot. Do you know, you guys know Henry Sakaida? You heard of him as a Pacific War historian? He
No,
passed
sir.
away quite some time ago. But Henry would did a lot of correspondence with veterans. And I was living in Japan at the time, and Henry called me and said, "Hey, you want to meet Ken Walsh?" And I was like, "Yeah, he lives in Santa Ana, really close to my mom." And my mom sent me a newspaper clipping that Ken Walsh wanted to return something to Japan. Kind of things just kind of came together. So I came home, went over to Ken Walsh's house, met Henry there, and talked to Ken Walsh. All the stuff in his house, memorabilia, everything. He had this pilot's leg board. It's about this big, made of aluminum, plexiglass on the front, with handwritten notes in front in Japanese. And there's blood splattered on it. And it was is in Quantico for like the last 30 years. He had loaned it to them. And he said, I'm dying. I'm getting old. I've got all these illnesses. I'm not going to be here. I want to return this to the family in Japan. I want you boys to help me." So Henry and I worked together, and we found the dead Japanese pilot's commanding officer and his nephew. And so I took the legboard back to Japan with me. I contacted both of them, sent them photos, you know, everything about Ken. And so we arranged a meeting to return it at the Nagoya Airport second floor domestic terminal, where they used to have a zero. So we stood in front of the zero, and the squadron commander accepted this legboard and blood splattered on it. There was a little drawing of a chicken holding a sword, jumping up and like saying banzai. And there was little triangles and circles and squares where he was like waiting for orders to tick off. He's like, it's strapped to his leg, right? And they use that to write like their destinations and times and flight times. And he's just on his little, he's like, I want to play baseball again. When can we play baseball? Will they hold the World Series again? I wonder if Roosevelt will go for a fourth term. And he's writing, he's just doodling on this paper. And there's blood splattering on top of all that. And I looked at it and I'm like, this guy was just a human being. He's writing about Roosevelt. He's drawing a picture of a chicken with a samurai helmet and a sword, like a really stupid little silly drawing. So we find the nephew and the commanding officer who tells us all about that last mission, the final mission, Okinawa, April 1st, what happened. And then we meet the nephew. He says, yeah, my uncle said he was going to fly over the house three times on his final mission. And I remember that day he flew over our farmhouse three times at night, and we knew it was him. And he had a postcard from the dead pilot. And we were like looking at that, like just amazed, right? So that item is now at the Chiron Museum, the Kamikaze Museum down in Kyushu, because the nephew passed away and his kids donated it to the Chiron Museum. And all these little stories happened just because Ken Walsh said, "I'm old, I want to return this." And it just snowballed through Henry. And so what was cool is that my general manager, the one who lost his mom and his family at Hiroshima, well, It became out in a newspaper article the next day with photos of me and the commander and the nephew in front of that Zero holding this leg board. I didn't tell him about it. It wasn't a big deal. But I guess the nephew sent it into the newspaper and it got turned into an article. He sees that. He stands up the whole office and they give me like a standing applause. And I'm like, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. So wow. I was like, this is the guy who lost half his family in Hiroshima. And he's having the whole group office, you know, give me an applause or something. And I was just felt it was the right thing to do. And it's just weird how these things just kind of connect and they go in circles. And that's all very good positive energy, you know. Let me plug my third book real quick.
Please.
This one, Blossoms from the Sky. And this was a similar, this guy actually, Mr. Suzuki, Hideo Suzuki, he volunteered for the Oka Project and I met him. I got to interview him. I was introduced to him by a girl I met on Peneloo, a Japanese historian. She was walking along the road, you know, 100 degree heat. And me and friend John Edwards, the Marine, Gunny, we stop and go, hey, you need a ride? And she's like, I'm from Japan. I go, I speak Japanese. So she hopped in. We start talking. So she's a history buff. We've been friends for years now. And I said, I'd like to interview kamikazes. And she goes, oh, yeah, I mean, Mr. Suzuki. And boom. He goes, oh, you're a friend of hers? Okay, you're fine. Come on, I'll meet you.
That's
and
awesome.
There he is. He's holding, can you see it?
He's holding wow. his shirt. Yeah, sure him. Thing.
That's him. And he volunteered for the program. And the thing that I think most of us don't really think about or understand is that at that time, the Japanese soldiers, sailors, airmen, they were all fighting for their country, just like we were fighting for ours. Because the government controlled the media. Where have we heard that before? Media, newspaper, print, radio, all controlled by one source, the Japanese military. Music, radio, broadcasts, plays, songs, movies, all must go towards a war effort. There was no counter information. The Americans were bloodthirsty. They were... They were alcoholics. They raped women. They ate babies. They were lazy and listless. They were weak and they had low IQs and like every racial stereotype you can imagine about the enemy and that they were trying to control and enslave all of Asia. So the Japanese government, they had this propaganda. It is Asia for the Asians. And it was really easy for them to do because all they had to do is tell the people, who's in Hong Kong right now? British. Who's in Indonesia? Oh, French. Oh, okay. Who's in the Philippines? Americans. What do all these people have in common? They are white and they speak English and they're Westerners, and they're Europeans, and they're all trying to enslave us. And the people went, kind of makes sense. Yeah, what are these people doing here? You know, so they start... Their propaganda was, let's free all of our Asian and brown brothers, India, Malaysia, Asia, China, free everyone from Western oppression. That's a pretty tasty pill to swallow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we saw the results of the rapists and cannibals. We saw the results of that on Saipan, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually a good point. I was wondering, did you talk to anybody about that, Dan, that had seen the suicide cliffs and whatnot? Bonsai cliff at Saipan.
Yeah, Mr. Shimoda saw people jumping off the cliffs, and he was angry about that as well because the people were lied to. All these women throwing their babies off the cliffs, they did that because they loved them.
Right.
As a dad, as a grandpa, I get it. I can end my own child's life painlessly by whipping them off a cliff onto the rocks or in the ocean, or let some Americans torture them and do unspeakable things to them. There's no choice, right?
Yeah.
You love your family. But a lot of the older veterans I talked to, they really believe that their government did them wrong and that there's no balance, right? And it's wartime, so there usually isn't. And then so after the war, the occupation troops, the soldiers and sailors start coming in. And you know the sister of the kamikaze pilot who let me photograph this?
Yes, sir.
This is Masuda. This is Haruhi Masuda. She fell in love with an American, a guy from Texas, a guy named Davey, a U.S. soldier in Japan, occupation guy. And she was telling me, she goes, they told us when the Americans landed as occupiers, they were going to destroy our country, bulldoze all our temples, take all the men off the coal mines in the U.S., and rape and pillage and everything. And she says, you know, Dan-san, the soldiers came in, they were chewing gum and whistling and giving chocolate to kids and laughing and smiling. And they were dressed real sharp and they were very polite and respectful. And she goes, that made me so mad. My brother died to kill these people. Why are we fighting these people? These are nice people. And the man was from Texas and he proposed to her, but she couldn't accept because if she married him and moved back, moved to the US, then her mother would be alone. So she couldn't do it. And she had a photograph of he and her together taken in Tokyo in 1946, oh no, 47. And it was ripped and taped back together. And I go, why'd you rip it? She goes, ah, I got married 2 years later and my Japanese husband found it and he ripped it and got so angry. So that night I snuck out to the trash and I pulled it back out and I taped it together and I hid it. And she's been hiding it since 1948.
Wow.
Who had it?
Did
And
you ever
it
find
was
him?
strong. I said, he signed the back. He said, you know, to my honey, love Davy. And it had like the name, it looked like Garcia or Gareza or something. I can't remember. I got a photo somewhere. And I go, shall we look for him? I bet we can find him. She goes, no, I don't want to. No, he's probably got married and has a wife and a family and children and grandchildren. I don't want to bother him or cause any trouble to him. It's just my sweet memory from when I was young. And I went,
Wow.
so I
Beautiful.
didn't look for him. She asked me not to.
Beautiful story. Goodness
But
gracious.
those, I think a lot of the American GIs that went into Japan after the war, they really won the hearts and minds of Japanese people. You talk to anybody over 85 in Japan, I don't care where you go, Hokkaido to Okinawa, anywhere. And if they've met an occupier, an American occupier, they'll say the same thing. Candy, chocolate, really nice, very polite, jazz music, always spending money, just positive, positive, positive. And it's what the
Wow.
government's tried to do, these lowly GIs undid it all in just like a year of occupation. That's something I feel pretty happy about.
It's almost like the original versions of Hearts and Minds.
Yeah, absolutely. Like done correctly.
I'm sorry. So circle back to this one. This is the Oka pilots, the Baka bombs. And this Mr. Suzuki, he talked about the training program. There's lots of photographs and maps, all unpublished. Nobody's
Dan,
heard this
how do
before.
people get your books?
They're available on Amazon. All three of
What's
these as
the
well.
name of the one for those that aren't going to be watching the video? What's the name of it?
So the first one is The Last Zero Fighter. And the second one is A Tomb Called Iwo Jima. And the third one is Blossoms from the Sky. Because
And
the
what's the
Oka.
book about your dad? What's that one called?
You know what? I don't have that one right now. I had one, but I gave it away last week. It's called The Yalu River Boys, and it's about a B-29 crew that went out on a mission on April 12th, 1951, to bomb the bridges connecting North Korea with China at the city of Sinuiju, connecting the MiG base at Antong. And my dad's crew, the back half of the plane bailed out over the Yalu River. They were shot up by Russian piloted MiG-15s. My dad got to meet some of the pilots that shot him down when he was in captivity. He was taken to China for a week of interrogation, and he met several of the Russian Caucasian pilots, and one of them was a German. And they were real cordial, friendly, you know. Like, I got
Wow.
you. We shot you from the back. He's like, yeah, I was shooting you. And they've been talking with their hands, you know. But the back half of the crew spent 867 days in a series of North Korean gulags,
Ooh.
re-education centers, concentration camps. About half of the POWs died from malnutrition, illness, torture, starvation, mistreatment by the communists. No letters from home, no Bibles. No singing at all, no Sunday school service, no church services. Three of the four captured padres or priests died in captivity. They really hated the religious clergy. The communists really hated them. And so it was a pretty bad experience. And if someone's interested in like B-29 missions and the workings of the B-29, you get a lot of research. Or if you want to know about being a POW, being held by the communists, what they think and how they feel, and how many American, British, and French people help the North Koreans with propaganda, how many American printed newspapers and magazines were used to brainwash American POWs. I was shocked. The more I dug into it, the more I learned. I was shocked that British, French, and Canadian and Americans were aiding the communists in trying to break the Americans and turn them into good little commies. So
Wow.
it's a heavier book. It's not as fun and light as the others, but
Wow.
something.
That's quite a statement when you say it's not as fun and light as Iwo Jima.
Yeah,
That's
yeah. Iwo
quite a
Jima would be a
statement.
nice, refreshing read after the Yalu River experience. Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. But I've got another book coming out. It's about the Mr. Shimoda, the survivor in the Saipan tank battle, and who held out on Saipan, and how he brought two of the tanks back from Saipan, and
What
one's an
progress have you got
ex-POW.
on that book? Where are you at in the writing process?
I'm doing the illustrations and maps right now, so the book is written, and now I'm
Oh,
just doing
good.
maps and
Excellent.
illustrations. Lots of never before published photos and illustrations. And he loves Americans. That's the one thing that blew me away is all the Japanese veterans love American people. They love Americans. Even the guys who are POWs.
How can you explain that, Dan?
I don't know. The only thing I can think of is how they were treated by Americans after the war. And how, like, they were told Americans were horrible, horrible, evil, evil. And then they meet Americans and they're like, they're not. They're allies, they're friends, they're helping us. And it's through individual interactions when you meet people who are different than you, right? And then you turn out to be nice. So I received a lot of goodwill thanks to Americans who were in the occupation force because they associate me with them, right? And so I really appreciate the veterans who went into Japan and created so much goodwill.
Jeff, you got to be chomping at the bit. I mean, I see you over there. You've got to have, and we're gonna have Dan. Would you be willing to come back again?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because there's no way we can get. I mean, we've all got so many questions. Jeff, what have you got?
Well, Dan, I have to first start with we have a mutual friend that I spoke with earlier today that wanted to tell you hi. I've known him for about 10 years now, and I think you just saw him a month or so ago. Yoshiro Kishida.
Oh, yeah, Kishida-san. Oh, yeah, I saw him at Fredericksburg. The tank, we're looking at the
Right.
tank. What a nice guy. Small
there's
world.
that. You probably met the mechanic that's working down there in Fredericksburg. A few years ago, I left the museum about 3 years ago. So when I was the living history director at the time, and so that was the time that we had repainted those tanks. The mechanic that's still working there painted the camouflage. You're looking at the guy that painted all of the insignia on the Hago and the Chiha
Nice.
because we felt the
Yeah.
same way.
Good job.
And it was right around that same time. I've done some, I guess you could say, piddling in the film industry with independent film advising and things like that. And so I totally appreciate, obviously, nothing to the scale that you've done. But I think with the same eye for detail, because I feel the same way that there's going to be somebody who knows. And that was important. So you probably recognize the Hago was a command tank at Peleliu, and of course the Type 97 was from the Regiment Iwo Jima, and we did that on purpose.
Blue arrow. I
So
went, hey, Iwo Jima, blue arrow.
there you
Yeah.
go.
She says on the phone,
Yeah.
well, you know that. I go, eh.
Lots of fun there, and you're also looking at the guy that organized the only time that Herschel Williams fired a World War II flamethrower since the war. And
Wow.
it was in a Holiday Inn parking lot at Wichita Falls, Texas. That's a story for another time.
Was that at the 5th Marine Division reunion?
It was.
Okay, I went to three of those. I must have missed that one.
You would have remembered it.
You would have
Yeah, I guess.
remembered.
Yeah, I would remember that. I would remember that. Yeah.
You would have,
Oh, wow.
yeah. Yeah, a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh.
So, and again, you said it best too. There's things, and I'm in the same category, and I know Don and Dennis are also in this category. Things just kind of find us. You couldn't imagine some of the artifacts I have from families, passed down for generations, artifacts from the war, because they know I'll give it a home. It won't be in the attic. It won't be forgotten. It will be shared on What's the Scuttlebutt, or with other veterans or other historians. But yeah, I know we're running long. I've got so much, Dan, to share with you. I want to share photographs and a letter and an envelope that was given to me by the daughter of the sailor who found it in a dead Japanese soldier's pocket at Eniwetok. Yoshiro translated it for me, but I'd love to send pictures of that. And Yoshiro
Wow.
also gave me a last year. He gave me a flag that he said was made from material at Kure Naval Base during the war. He gave me a
Wow.
nice Japanese flag. So
Wow.
we got a lot to talk about. And Dennis says you're in Waco.
I live in Rockwall. It's about
Oh, Rockwell.
5 minutes east of Dallas on I-30, depending on traffic.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought I saw Waco. So still, we're not too far. I'm down in the Hill Country. I'm between you and Dennis. In fact, Dennis and I will be in Dallas for Warbird Weekend, first weekend in May. We'll be there Friday through Sunday at
Oh, really?
CAGIF
Yes.
headquarters.
Oh,
So
okay.
we've got to figure out a way to get you
Yeah, let me
there.
know and I'll swing
Yeah.
by.
Oh, that'd
Yeah,
be so
absolutely.
awesome.
Cool.
Yes.
Awesome.
We've
Dan,
got
we've
to
got to
do that.
get you back on here again. This has
For
just
sure.
been, yeah.
I'll tell you my Saburo Sakai story and the
Oh.
Fredericksburg connection to that, how I interviewed him in his home
Oh
for
my
almost 7 hours
goodness.
straight. He exhausted me. I was begging to be left. Let me leave. Let me go. I'm tired. He was amazing. Amazing. He tried to
Yeah.
make me put on his flight helmet. He physically tried to put it on my head. He made me rub my finger on his bullet pin on his
Yeah.
head. I was like,
Wow.
holding my hand. He's like, putting my hand. I'm like, Really amazing, funny, sharp, brilliant, wonderful person.
Yeah.
Sakai-san, really, almost all the veterans I've met are like that. The World War II veterans, they're survivors. They're
Oh,
like
man.
miniature Buddhas. They're friendly. They're full of love and compassion, and they're intelligent and they're sharp and they're patriotic guys, just like our American veterans.
Yes.
They're very
Well,
similar.
it's a date. First Saturday of May.
Okay.
We're setting up camp Friday. We're camping there at the hangar, and we'll set our big Air Corps display up. Dennis is going to dress up with
Okay.
me.
Very
Saturday
cool.
evening. Saturday evening, we're going to share some stories, sir.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I look forward to
And
it.
we'll have you on for a follow-up episode maybe here in a week or two. Get with Dennis behind the scenes and we'll get you on the calendar again and we'll do another episode and Jeff
Yeah,
can
Dan,
dig
this has
deep with
just
you.
been tremendous. Yeah.
I know how to use this now, so
And real quick before we go, we want to thank each and every one of you for your continued support, and we really want to hear from you. We don't hit this enough. Email us at mailcall@wtspworldwar2.com. Give us your insights, your criticisms, your suggestions. Maybe there's a topic you want us to cover that we have yet to cover in the last 5 years.
Yeah,
We
Don, as a
want to
matter of
hear from
fact,
you.
because we're going to have Dan on again, maybe they have some questions they wouldn't want to ask Dan.
Very good point.
Send in the questions.
We have spent years talking about the Pacific Theater of Operations between me, Jeff, Dennis, and Henry. Now we have someone who has probably more knowledge on the opposite side than the three of us had combined on the Allied side. So any questions you've wanted to have answered about the Japanese side of the war, please send them to us at mailcall@wtspworldwar2.com. And when we have Mr. King on, we will definitely get those out there and have him answer those. Dan, where can people find you? Are you on social media? You got Instagram? You got a website? We know you can get your books on Amazon. You have any other place you want to direct people so they can keep up to date with your new projects?
Well, my website is historicalconsulting.com. Just one long word, historicalconsulting.com. And they can contact me through there. They can find my books on Amazon. I'm also on Facebook under Dan King. If you want to send me an email, you contact one of these guys and they'll give you my email address. I'm happy to help out with translations where I can or advice or information. He loved the topic of World War II in the Pacific, just like you guys. I'm very passionate about it.
Yes.
I'm happy to correspond with like-minded folks.
And as always, you guys can find all those corresponding links and photos and all the good stuff related to this episode over at WTSPWorldWar2.com. For myself, Jeff Copsetta, Dennis Blocker, and Mr. Dan King, thank you guys, and we will talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.